Well, in case anybody missed it, the free market, it broke. They're not sure what happened. There's allegations that it was interfered with, possibly there's tampering. Possibly somebody slipped it a Mickey, spiked its drink at the cocktail party. They're not sure. But Alan Greenspan, who is the former head of the US Federal Reserve Bank, has said that he is in a state of shocked disbelief that the entire intellectual edifice of the modern risk management paradigm has simply collapsed. And closer to home, the associate editor of the Age newspaper, Sean Carney, wrote just last month, and I'll quote him. He said, he was very perplexed. He said, "This is an age of expertise. Humanity has never been better educated, more technologically equipped, better connected, seemingly more informed, and yet, since late last year, it's found itself being sucked into an economic vortex." And he goes on, "There's something innately sad about the way in which all our sophistication, our knowledge, our access to history have done little, if anything, to stave off this recession." And you can understand why Sean Carney would be perplexed about this, because a lot of people are perplexed. Certainly in my lifetime, you would think, you get the impression that the world has been run by economists. There has not been one piece of policy that has been proposed by any government that hasn't had the backing of Treasury projections or the Treasury figures, or that has been backed by a so-called panel of experts that always has the obligatory economist checking off whether or not this piece of policy is going to be okay, or whether or not there has been some independent consultancy done by Access Economics or the like. Everything has had to be, everything has needed the tick of approval of economists, yet we find ourselves in a situation where the economy has simply crumbled. Now, the perplexity that most of us might have towards this and that Sean Carney expresses, it's actually not that difficult to understand, because I'd argue that mainstream economics isn't actually about understanding the world. It isn't really about scientific inquiry. Actually, it's almost pure ideology. Mainstream economics paints a picture of a world that does not exist in order to justify the one that actually does. In fact, they paint a world that doesn't exist and try and push it on the rest of us. So mainstream economics takes as its starting point this idea that the world is inhabited by individuals who are inherently self-interested and pursue the maximisation of our pleasure through consuming or through purchasing goods and services on the market, and in so doing, generate the greatest welfare for society as a whole. Now, this is absolute nonsense. It's a historical fiction. It's an ideological fiction. It's simply not the way the world works. Now, given that, you might ask, well, what's different then about Marxist economics? Surely economics is just about all this data. You've got charts, you've got indices, you've got GDP, you've got unemployment rates, you've got exchange rates, you've got charts, you've got the mathematical equations. It all gets put up in this big ball of quantitative data that an expert economist then reads off, interprets in a particular way, and tells us exactly how the world is. Well, in part, yes, but primarily, this is not the way Marxists see economics. Marxists take a fundamentally different starting point to mainstream economics. Marxists take the starting point of human existence. That is concrete, historical, and social fact that before human beings can do anything, before we can come to a conference like this, before we can go to the theatre, before we can play football, before we can come to grips with the way the world works, we actually have to be alive. Sounds pretty obvious, but this is something that is overlooked or ignored in most mainstream theoretical accounts of the way the world works. So Marxists take our starting point then from the idea that in order to be alive, we have to produce the things that we need to survive. We have to produce the food, we have to make our clothes, and we have to make the habitats that we're going to live in. And Marxists say that the starting point for understanding any human society, or the basis for any human society, is the conscious labouring activity of the people within that society, that or the labouring activity is undertaken in order to satisfy our human needs. That's the first point. And the second point of Marx economics is saying that the relationships that people enter into in the course of producing those things that we need, the social relationships or the class relationships, fundamentally determine the sort of society it is that we live in and determine the direction that that society will take in terms of its development. So with those two things in mind, there's a lot to talk about in the field of Marxist economics, but I'm going to give a fairly non-technical, well, completely non-technical, hopefully, introduction and go through some of the fundamentals, but I won't be able to cover it all. But I want to start with what is the cornerstone of Marxist economics, and that is what's called the labour theory of value. And labour theory of value is simply the theory of the total value that is created in a capitalist society as a whole. Now, when you think about this thing, value, or something being valuable, at first sight, it appears as though it's the property of things, of objects. So if you walk into your local Harvey Norman, for example, and there's a big black leather couch, it has a price tag on it. Price tag says $1,000. So the price, as anybody might guess, expresses something about this couch, expresses its value, what it's worth. However, we start to run into difficulties when we're now Harvey Norman, and they're not just selling couches. Because you go to the other side of the store, they'll have a little white laptop computer, also $1,000. Now, you don't have to be a genius, of course, at this point to say, well, they're both cost the same amount, so they're both worth the same thing. You could pretty much just exchange one for the other and swap them. Well, that's fairly basic. But when you start looking at these two different things, you notice that they're completely different physically. They're different shapes, different sizes, different weights, different colours, made of completely different materials. In fact, they have completely different uses. So how is it then, two things which are completely physically different, that share no qualities physically alike at all, how is it that we can compare them and decide that they have the same amount of value in it? When Karl Marx was thinking about this question, he answered, and he wasn't the first to answer this, but he answered it probably most systematically. He answered that, well, they may not have anything physically alike, but these two objects have some common social quality. And that quality is that they are the products of human labour. And so Marx reasoned that the basis of their being able to be compared is the fact that they're being laboured upon, and the value of the objects is simply a measure of the time it has taken and the human energy it's taken, on average, to produce different goods. And that this human labour, then, is the basis, not just of these two physical objects, but if you think about the entire world of exchange, you know, every second of the day, billions of goods and services being swapped and traded on the international market, well, the basis of that is human labour. And the exchange process, where you see two things being swapped and traded and exchanged, bought and sold, all this is people comparing the amount of social labour that's gone into these objects on average. So that's the labour theory of value. It's quite simple. It's very controversial, but it's quite simple. The thing about capitalism that you start to see a distortion coming about when we start thinking about value. The thing about capitalism is the exchange of goods in some ways dominates the production of goods. And that's to say that the value of things, this abstract measure of human labour, that starts to dominate the actual use of the objects. And this is just really another way of saying that profit dominates human need. And to explain what I mean by that, if you think about pre-capitalist societies, say a feudal society, you've got peasants. Now, peasants produce food because they need to eat. The production of food takes on a direct social consumptive purpose. And so they produce for themselves, but they also produce a bit extra because the nobility or the lord also wants to eat. And this is true of most human societies, except for capitalism. Thank you. Now, capitalism turns all this upside down, because in capitalism, we don't produce food to feed people. Now, you might think, if you take a glance at society, you might think, well, that's not true really, because farmers grow carrots and other vegetable products and agricultural products because we need to eat. We go to the supermarket, we buy it. There's a human need that this production serves a purpose for. Same with the shirt, really. You think we're all sitting here wearing clothes. Well, the reason for that is, well, we all need to stay warm. And that's why somebody starts a textile factory. Appearances can be deceptive, though. And I think when you look at the appearance, it appears like that. That's why it's an appearance, obviously. Mainstream economics doesn't really penetrate this.
He's a genius. I know. You're not saying this guy's a genius.
But okay, so you think, penetrate the surface. And let's look at, for example, the production of food. Again, now under capitalism, the United Nations Development Programme annual report of 2006 stated that there's about 800 million people around the world who are suffering hunger and starvation. And from Sandra's talk earlier in the weekend, I think that's now up to about a billion people. This is a time of the 800 million at a time of capitalist prosperity. And despite the fact that the figures show, we produce enough food on the planet to feed twice as many people as we actually have. So what the hell's going on here? Well, the thing that's going on is the food isn't produced to feed people. And it becomes clear when you see why aren't people eating? Because they can't afford to eat. The most important thing in capitalism isn't satisfying this human need to eat. Same with houses in the United States. They're not building houses to house people, obviously, because they're getting kicked out. Things are produced in order to grab that value, to generate the profits. So value dominates. And the acquisition of value, the search for profits, dominates human need. And you think how mad this is. Now, because if I walked in here, if we go downstairs for dinner tonight, we're all sitting around, I've ordered chicken parmigiana. And everyone's sitting around eating, you're eating your chicken parmigiana, somebody's got some wedges, everybody's chomping away, and I'm sitting there looking at my food, looking up, looking at my food, and someone's like, Ben, why aren't you eating your chicken parmigiana? And I turn around and I say, look, I'm not eating my chicken parmigiana because the parmigiana's told me I'm not allowed to eat it. People look and say, oh, God, he's lost the plot. I can't believe this. But this is what we do every time we say we can't afford to eat or that someone can't afford to eat. How is it that someone can't afford to eat? You think, as a society, we've produced all the things. Human beings have produced all the food we need to eat, yet we put the food up in this thing called the market, and then we stand down below it, and the market and the objects themselves tell us that we can't have access to the very things we created as a society. This is madness. We're being dictated to by inanimate objects. It's true. Marx called it commodity fetishism. It's actually a real phenomena where the products we produce become divorced from us and we have no control of them, and they dictate our lives. Now, if you bring back the spirit of Sean Carney and say, with all our knowledge, with all our ingenuity, with all our understanding, with all our progress, how on earth do we get into a situation where we're dominated by inanimate objects, the things that we've already created? Well, the answer lies not in the fact that people are stupid or people don't know enough or we don't have enough knowledge. Actually lies in the second thing that I mentioned at the start, when I said, Marxists say the basis of human society is conscious labouring activity, but the second thing being, the nature of that society is determined by the sorts of relationships people enter into in the process of production, class relationships. So that's the second point in starting to understand how we get dominated by these objects and how profit dominates human need. In a capitalist society, you've got two main classes. There are more than that, but the two main ones, excuse me. The two main ones, you've got the ruling class and the working class. Now, ruling class are defined by the fact they control all those instruments, all the things we need to actually do the production, to produce the things we need. So the factories, the office space, computers, machinery, the land, the ports, the electricity grid, the trains, the trucks, all those things that we need. The working class, the other major class, which is the majority, do all the work, well, defined in the opposite by really our non-control of those things, the fact that we don't have access to all the means of production. Now, if you're a worker in a capitalist society, obviously, you still need to eat. Now, in order to eat, you have to purchase your food.
In order to purchase your food, you have to have money. And in order to have money, you have to sell things. That's the way capitalism works. The only thing workers have to sell, however, is our capacity to labour, precisely because we don't own all these other things. So in the course of this, we, if feeding ourselves, we have to enter into what is a human relationship of domination. That is, we have to sell our capacity to labour to somebody else who then controls our labouring activity. That very thing that is the base of our society and the very thing that makes us human is controlled by somebody else for a number of hours while they give us a wage. Now, what happens in this number of hours? Well, firstly, we go to work, we produce the goods and services for the boss. The capitalist goes and sells them, gives us our wage at the end of it. That's not the only thing that's happened, though, is it? Because once we've got our wage, say $500, the boss then still has money to reinvest in the company, to pay the electricity bills, all the bills of the company, to pay for his or her house, for his or her children's upkeep, for his or her holiday house and car and holidays, all those sorts of things. So while we've been given, we've created all this value, we've been given $500 in return for the value we create, but actually, we've created a whole lot more than that, say $1,000 per person. So what's happened? Well, exploitation's happened. And when we say exploitation's happened, this is, for Marx, we use this as a technical term. Usually, you know, in common parlance, when you talk about, well, exploitation, usually, you know, you feel like, well, it's that you're being treated like dirt or that you're not really appreciated. You're taken advantage of, although workers are taken advantage of, but more in a moral sense. Well, we actually mean exploitation in a very technical sense. Exploitation is simply the process by which we do not get the full value of that we generate. So we generate $1,000 worth of value, we only get paid $500 worth of that. And this is something that, I guess on one level, we have to do in order to eat. But it's important to see that for a boss, just as we have no choice but to be exploited if we're to eat and feed ourselves, a boss actually has no choice but to exploit us. And the reason for that is the way the capitalist dynamic is set up is that you have competing business units and the businesses have to compete against each other for these profits. And it's here, through this competitive process, that you start to see why profit gets put before human need and value dominates humanity as a whole and the market as a whole. Because while the boss is in competition with each other, if they're not generating profit, they can go out of business. They can go bankrupt or they can get taken over. So the first thing that a boss has to think about when they've got a business is how do they generate the most amount of value? For bosses, it's actually not human need or the usefulness of the things that matters. And it can't be if they're to feed their family. So we're caught in this bind. Bosses have to compete to generate profits and workers have to submit to the domination. All the while, all the goods get produced and determine all the things that are going to get produced in the future on the basis of what's profitable. Okay.
No, we'll take another drink.
What does this lead to in practice? There's a central contradiction which is at the heart of the capitalist system. Now, if you think about, we're looking at the bosses again. Right now, in order to compete, what do bosses usually need to do? Business 101 says more goods, more cheaply. That's sort of the bread and butter if you're going to stay in business. You have to produce quality products at a lower price so that you can undercut your competitors. Now, the way bosses do this is to invest in machinery. So if you think anybody's worked in a call center, things like headsets reduces the amount of time that you might otherwise have been doing this. Well, then they bring in auto dialers, which takes away the amount of time it takes to make a phone call so that calls just start auto-generating. As soon as somebody hangs up, the thing's calling again. Reduces the amount of time and labour that goes into every call, which means that call centre can undercut people. Or if you think about the mining industry, think a long time ago, you see films of people in the mining industry. When they're digging out the minerals and the ores, you know, they've got the buckets and the pulleys or they've got the wheelbarrows and there's hundreds or thousands of people all working along. Well, Now we're at a point where you see a picture of an open cut mine, and the definitive picture is, you know, some bloke standing there next to a truck with a wheel about the size of this room. So the increase in the productivity of labour through investing in machinery is the central way that bosses can compete. The problem with this, and this is a contradiction, when we say contradiction, we mean like a state of affairs which tends to produce conflict or breakdown in the system. The conflict out of all this comes by virtue of the fact that the first capitalist that invests in machinery, which is designed to save labour, therefore make products cheaper, is at a great advantage. Because if you're the first boss to introduce an auto dialer in the call centre, well then you can offer the services of the call centre a lot cheaper than the other call centres. The problem comes in though when once one capitalist has done it, well, all the other capitalists have to do it as well if they're to stay competitive. So you create a new level playing field where investment in machinery has gone up compared to labour. But then somebody else has another investment and another investment. And you have this competitive process until the amount that capitalists have to actually invest into an enterprise becomes enormous. And you think about some of these, the GM, you know, the car manufacturers or the giant mining firms, huge stores of machinery compared to the amount of labour that they now use. This creates tremendous problems because it becomes much more difficult to generate profits. And what Marx identified, what he called the central law of economics, was the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. I'm not going to go into the technicalities of that, but all it effectively means is that through this process, it does become harder to generate profits. And if you think about an analogy to demonstrate, I guess, exactly what it means, if you think about a bank that offers 20% interest, now the first year you go to the bank, say, okay, 20% interest, I put $100 in, at the end of the year, I get $120 back. So I've made $20 from a $100 investment. Second year, however, because of all the competition, go to the bank and the bank's saying, it's 10% interest. So, okay, this time, if you want to make that $20 profit, you have to double your investment. It's got to be $200. Third year, it's 5% interest. To get the $20 profit, you've got to invest $400. And say that the last year, it's 1% interest, you actually have to invest $2,000 then to get that $200 back. Now, you can see the problem that starts emerging here. Because over time, if this rate of profit goes down, capitalists have to start thinking about how they are best going to keep their profits up. The first thing they start doing is attacking workers. Job cuts, making people work longer, cutting breaks, cutting paying conditions. Stuff that we're seeing all over the world at the moment, and we've been seeing in the United States for the last 30 years. However, it's not just about bosses attacking workers then, because this competitive dynamic ensures that bosses have to start attacking bosses in different ways. Hostile takeovers, bankruptcies, mergers and acquisitions. As companies go to the wall through this frenetic pace of competition where they can't generate the profits that they used to have. And ultimately, this contradiction finds what is possibly the highest expression. I don't even quote it on determining the determinations, whether it's the second highest or the highest determination, whatever. But in capitalist crisis. Because if you think, if capitalists have money to invest and this rate of profit has been declining, at some point, if you've got a stack of capital or money that you want to invest to realise value and generate profits, if the rate of profit's really low, you're actually going to hold on to your money. In the same way, let me use another analogy, because I see puzzled faces. In the same way that if you went to, say you go to the racetrack, and we're standing at the racetrack, and I walk up to you and I say, you know, I've got this hot tip in race 5. You give me $5, I'll bring you back 25. You probably go, yeah, that sounds like a decent risk. I'll put $5 in it for my 25. But if I come to you and say, you know what, give me $50, I'll bring you back 55, I've got a hot tip. You're not going to part with your $50. You're going to say, I don't think so. It's not worth the risk of me outlaying cash if the return is not sufficient enough. And even if, you know, if the return's only going to be that, I'd rather hold on to my money. So this is what, thank you,
this is what actually happens in the capitalist economy, and we're seeing some of it, the reflections of that in the economic crisis now, that capitalists hold on to their capital. Now, when we saw earlier that we see, when we produce all these things and the market determines whether or not we get to consume them, if we think this is madness, well, we've gone to another level of madness now, because now it's not just that workers have produced all this stuff that somehow we can't afford or we don't get access to. Now it's the fact that the process of exploitation, we're not even allowed to be part of that anymore. Exploitation sort of becomes a dream because you can't even get a job, because it's not just that the market's going to determine that we can't afford the things, but because the rate of profit's low, capitalists are going to determine that nobody's going to work. And so this creates a huge amount of carnage. Mass job losses, destruction of lives, destruction of capital, destruction of all the value that we've all created, while people are standing idly by with hands ready, waiting to work, with the resources ready, waiting to be used, with deeds to be done. You know, everybody can think of one thing that desperately needs to happen in this world, and all it would take is a number of hands, a few good minds, and a whole lot of resources. But none of it goes forward because the value that could be realized out of it is not enough that capitalists would be prepared to invest. It is absolute madness. Now, has this made sense? People make sense. Okay. Because that's the ABC of Marxist economics. It is very, on some level, it can get very complicated, and I've tried not to be too complex about it, but it's very easy. It's very basic at its heart, and let me run through, you know, to conclude, let's go through those steps again. But human labour is the basis of all human societies, that in capitalist society, only human labour creates value. Workers have to enter into a relationship of domination and be exploited and be parted, well, on one hand, we're divorcing the things that we require to produce the goods that we need to survive, on the one hand. On the second hand, once we go into the process of production, we actually do produce these goods, but the value of them and the goods themselves are lost to us and we don't get control over them. The competition between capitalists means that they're only interested, or they can only have an interest in profitability as opposed to human need. And this dynamic of competition between the enterprises leads to a situation of capitalist breakdown as the rate of profit does not hold up, and you get human misery on a widespread scale. And that can lead to war, but I'm not going to talk about that. And I'm just going to leave it there. Thanks.